The historian gave us regular feedback on what she was finding. And she also brought in oral historians to take our own life histories, because there's also a psychoanalytical point to be made here. You can take refuge in this scholarly exercise, going into archives and finding out things that happened hundreds of years ago. You can all too easily remove yourself from that. This is what happened long, long ago. But we had all of us on this farm, we had all lived through apartheid. And so the oral historians, for those who wanted to participate, we met over many sessions in my living room, and the oral historians asked each of us who volunteered to participate to tell our stories of our lives. And it was a real revelation to me, despite the abstract awareness, the actual concrete listening to people who I was getting to know as individuals, to hear one after another account of the grinding poverty of what it actually is like to be a poor black farm worker in South Africa under apartheid.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Professor Mark Soames. Professor Soames is a member of the British, American, and South African Psychoanalytic Associations. He is the Director of Neuropsychology at the Neuroscience Institute of the University of Cape Town. Mark is well known in the field for his many contributions, but less well known for this one. And we discuss a paper he wrote that was published in 2015 in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association, entitled "Psychoanalysis in Pursuit of Truth and Reconciliation on a South African Farm." And that farm is his family's farm, a vineyard. And he walks us through a process where he returns from living in London to his home in South Africa with an intent to redress some of the terrible imbalances and inequalities that existed between the owner and the tenant farmers who are associated with farms in South Africa. He will explain all this to us. And he shares with us very transparently his naivete in feeling that his good wishes, his appreciation of history, and his well-meaning intent to contribute to a decent life for people who otherwise did not have, by his standards, a decent life, how that had to really mature. And he describes how he used his psychoanalytic mindset to dig into the past, not just of the land, but of the minds of both the tenant farmers and the owner, to create something new. And he created something dramatically new, built upon real mutual respect and understanding, that at the same time met the challenges of financial difficulties. And he will describe towards the end of our conversation some of those very considerable financial difficulties. But fortunately, things are looking up, and he'll walk us through that. Mark is an honorary fellow of the American College of Psychiatrists. He's received numerous awards, including the Sigourney Award. He has published 350 scientific papers and 8 books, the latest being The Hidden Spring. And most significantly, very recently, he's the authorized editor and translator of the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud, 24 volumes, and a forthcoming complete neuroscientific works of Sigmund Freud. I had a great pleasure in spending time with Mark, reading his work, getting to appreciate this facet of the man, and I have a feeling you will as well. Here is my conversation with Professor Mark Soames. Mark, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Javi.
When we think of psychoanalysis off the couch, we have a way of thinking about it, which is that it generally speaks to applying a clinical mindset to venues other than the consulting room. But Mark, you've introduced an additional perspective in bringing your analytic sensibility to the emotional, social, and even political challenge that you describe in engaging the slave history of your family's vineyard in South Africa. And this particularly played out in your relationship with the farmers who, as you will teach us, become linked to the farm, and they become part of your ownership. Again, you'll explain this to us, and how you struggled with that and how that evolved over time. It's a remarkable story. And I want to start off by reading an opening paragraph from the paper you wrote. This was published in 2015 in the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association. It was titled, Psychoanalysis in Pursuit of Truth and Reconciliation on a South African Farm. And I'm going to read that opening paragraph and then include a sentence from the end of the paper, and then I'll ask you to walk us through this. You wrote, having grown up in South Africa as a beneficiary of the apartheid system, I wanted to make a citizen-sized contribution to the reconstruction of the country by fixing the social fabric of just this one farm. I considered it appropriate to think small, as an individual citizen can easily be overwhelmed by the magnitude of the task faced by the country as a whole. However, I was aware of the symbolic significance of my historic farm. It was, after all, with the granting of such farms that the country's troubles began. Particularly daunting to me was the fact that when one acquires a farm in South Africa, even today, it typically comes with a community of black people who live on it. Not to put too fine a point on it, the farmer inherits the people who live on his land. Soames Delta, the name of the farm, came with 7 large families linked in complex ways with each other and with various extended families living on the surrounded farms. And in your last paragraph, you write, psychoanalysis played an important, if unexpected, role in this success. Now, we're going to spend a little bit of time at the end talking about the nature of this success and the unexpected struggles that you faced. But start us off. Tell us about your journey, your family's vineyard, and the spirit, intention, and conscious awareness of what you came back to do.
Thanks. Thank you, Harvey. Well, let me start with my family. We have been landowners forever. I mean, literally for centuries in Europe before one branch of my family emigrated here. And when we came here to South Africa, we became landowners again. And it's not quite the same as being a landowner in other parts of the world for exactly the reasons that you describe. The farm comes with people. The taking of these farms by the early settlers is where the trouble began, in the sense that that's the most concrete and literal embodiment of what colonization means. It means taking somebody else's land away from them. So it was, you know, I was very much aware, as I said in that extract that you just read, that when I returned to South Africa, which I did after I'd completed my psychoanalytical training, and which I did without expecting that I ever would be able to return, because I left during the darkest days of apartheid, and I broke the law by leaving without doing my military service, which was an obligation of all white males that we had to join the army. And I never did that. I skedaddled to England. So, you know, I came back with a psychoanalytic training. Of course, you know, you can't not be a psychoanalyst once you are one. But I didn't come with a specific psychoanalytic mission in mind, or with a psychoanalytic toolbox that I expected to make use of. I just wanted to come back and address the problems that belonged to me. I was delighted to be able to come back, but I was mindful of all of those historical things that I have referred to. If you grew up as I did in apartheid South Africa, whether you supported that system or not, you benefited from it. So I felt, and I still feel, that people of my generation, we owe a debt to this place. So I had a very amorphous notion that I want to come back. I want to make, as you quoted, a citizen-sized contribution. And symbolically, it's a pretty good place to do it. You know, at this farm was granted in 1690. The colony only started in the 1650s. So it was pretty early on that this farm was granted so generously by the governor, the granting of land that wasn't his to grant. I thought, well, let me tackle that social fabric in some way. That was the idea.
And so to put that in action, you described that you met with the farm workers.
Yes. So those seven extended families that you speak of, I had, in fact, I came on a very brief trip from London over a weekend. I hadn't yet relocated here. So it was a kind of reconnaissance trip. And I thought the first order of business is to meet the people who live on this farm. I set aside an hour for each to meet each family. And I began each of those 7 hours with a lunch break in between. So it was 8 hour day. I began each of those hours just introducing myself and saying, I'm the new owner. And although I might look like my predecessors, I'm not like them. You know, I want to do things differently. And so I want to align what we do on this farm with the newly hard won democracy. And since you live here and have lived here, you know, all your lives, tell me what you think we should do. What needs to be put right? What are the problems that we need to resolve? What should we prioritize? I want your guidance. So, you know, it was that sort of thing that I said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can see how amorphous was my plan. I didn't have a plan, except I just knew I wanted to change things. And I thought that was a perfectly sensible way to begin, to speak to the people most directly concerned with what needs changing and who had the most immediate familiarity with what was wrong. And the truth is that I barely got a word out of anybody. And that happened in each and every one of those 7 hours. When I asked those questions that I've just summarized, this was in my dining room in my house. They were all sitting around this large table, and they were just sort of shuffling their feet and shifting in their chairs and looking down at their feet and looking at each other awkwardly. I mean, there was literally silence, you know, and it happened time after time with each one of them. And some of them would say, you know, oh, it's not so bad, Professor, and pleased to meet you, and you know, we won't let you down, and things like, you know, platitudes like that. And it was clear to me, as I said, you know, you can't not be a psychoanalyst when you are one. So psychologically, what I felt was that they were intimidated by me. They were scared of me. They were mistrustful of me. It was completely outside of their experience that the owner asks them for their opinions about anything, let alone about how to, you know, run the farm. And I think it was mistrust and fear and whatnot, but also just, what's this guy smoking? You know, I mean, where's he come from?
And you're right, then things went from bad to worse.
Yes, so because they didn't give me any advice and offered no opinions, I unilaterally introduced the most obvious reforms. I mean, the ones that most obviously needed implementing. Things like, I mean, it will be shocking for our audience to hear some of these things, but it is not normal practice that farm workers, these tenant workers, people who live on your land, it's not normal practice that you give them employment contracts. In other words, they don't have any of the rights that come with formal employment. They are absolutely at your mercy. So if it's raining, you know, they don't work and then they don't get paid. For example, you know, if somebody's ill, they don't get paid. If somebody's has a baby, they don't get paid. You know, that's the kind of thing that's the norm. Also, there wasn't hot water in their homes. They didn't have internal toilets. They used outhouses. There wasn't electricity, you know, these sorts of things. So it was pretty obvious what needed doing, you know, draw up employment contracts, fix the houses, make them, you know, just like basically decent accommodations and so on. And the last thing I would have predicted would have happened is what happened. Once I did that, which I would have thought showed, you know, I was putting my money where my mouth is. I meant what I said. I'm not like my predecessors. I want to change things. What started happening was people started leaving work early, coming late, if at all, on Mondays. Things would go missing, including important things like the irrigation pump was stolen. People were chopping down the trees in my forest. And it was just, you know, I felt I was being taken for a ride. You know, I was being taken advantage of. My goodwill was being abused.
You said you feared for your life also.
Well, I wouldn't say I feared for my life, but it was scary, you know, to go into the forest and find somebody's cut down a tree. I mean, a great big tree. And then you ask around, what's happening? You know, and nobody tells you. And then you know, the next day another tree or two have been cut down. It's, you know, you feel as if there's something very sinister going on. And I think, of course, there's not only one explanation for it, but I think that if I could generalize, the overarching conclusion that I came to was that they thought I was a fool. You know, that this guy doesn't know how to run a farm. He doesn't know how things work. He's an idiot. Let's, you know, make hay while the sun shines, because this is not going to last. And so I started to feel that I'd been put in my place, if I can put it that way, in the sense that I now started to feel like a proper white farmer feels in South Africa. You know, the white farmer is angry with the black workers. That's the norm. And so the weight of history had just sort of fallen. And I started to have this kind of, these people are not grateful, you know, etc. I started thinking and feeling like a racist white farmer. And so it was this is what I mean by put in my place. I felt as if there was an inertia that we are not on the same side. We're never going to be on the same side. Don't be a fool to think that we're on the same side, you know, and that was a crisis.
The way you put it, you said you were left perhaps with a countertransference experience of, if I, the farmer, did not assume the customary role of being the abuser, then I would become the one who was abused. But sadomasochism was the language of the interaction.
Yes.
And then you had an awareness, and you write, "My psychoanalytic training then came to my rescue. In my desperation, I remembered the old quip, don't just do something, stand there. So for several months, I did nothing, withstanding the urge to act before I understood the predicament I was in." And then you described, being the clinician you are, how does one encounter somebody? Well, you've already encountered it through the countertransference. And now let's take a history. And there's this wonderful process that I'll ask you to describe about the whole engagement with your interest in history. You're bringing in archaeologists and historians and digging up the soil. Share with us that journey.
Yeah, so it was really at this point, after I started to have those thoughts and feelings that I described to you, that my psychoanalytical mind came to the fore. In other words, I started explicitly thinking about this in psychoanalytical terms. As I felt these very unpleasant and unwelcome and unflattering feelings, you know, I thought, this is countertransference. This is an enactment. Mm-hmm. This is something that is being transferred from some past situation that we are all in the grip of. And these are psychoanalytical ideas. Mm-hmm. And the idea that I mustn't defensively react, you know, that I must rather try to remove myself from the transference, counter-transference enactment and think about and just try to understand before, try to understand analytically what's happening before doing anything. And that was when this notion of the weight of history, which is, of course, such a deeply psychoanalytical notion. I mean, it is a general medical notion that one, in order to understand a clinical picture, you take a history. You want to know, when did the symptoms begin, under what circumstances, in what context, how did they develop? This helps you to reach a diagnosis. And you could say that psychoanalysis, unlike medicine, the whole treatment is a history taking. You know, it's not something preliminary to the treatment. It is the treatment. And so I had that idea, which I immodestly felt was an inspired idea, that what we need to do.
I thought so too, frankly, right.
we need to take a history. And it's not that I need to take a history, because it's not as if I was the doctor and they were the patients. The relationship between the landowner and the tenant workers was the pathology. There was something dreadfully wrong in the way that we were relating to each other. So we needed professional help, and the professions that I drew upon were not medical, but rather historians and archaeologists, for them to come and take the history with us of what happened here. So fortunately, because I'm an academic, I have access to such people at my university. And I brought in, in parallel, two processes. The one was I employed, in fact, full-time, an historian to do the archival research give us the story, the documented history of what happened here. Incidentally, I must tell you, nothing extraordinary happened here. What happened here is the same thing that happened on all of the old farms. But that's not the point. This is our farm, and we wanted to know what version of that horror story happened here. And the historian gave us regular feedback on what she was finding. And she also brought in oral historians to take our own life histories, because, you know, there's also a psychoanalytical point to be made here. You can take refuge in this scholarly exercise, going into archives and finding out things that happened hundreds of years ago. You can all too easily remove yourself from that. This is what happened long, long ago. But we had all of us on this farm, we had all lived through apartheid. And so the oral historians, for those who wanted to participate, we met over many sessions in my living room, and the oral historians asked each of us who volunteered to participate to tell our stories of our lives. And it was a real revelation to me, despite the abstract awareness, the actual concrete listening to people who I was getting to know as individuals, to hear one after another account of the grinding poverty of what it actually is like to be a poor black farm worker in South Africa under apartheid. The stories about people remembering when they got their first pair of shoes, which incidentally would usually be they'd get one pair of shoes, which they would wear to church and to school. And this was a prized possession. I said, I don't remember. I have no recollection of getting shoes. They just sort of came with the territory. And I had plenty of pairs of shoes. And one of the farm workers taking part in this exercise said to me, "Yes, but Professor, you were born with shoes on." Hmm. It was a sort of poetic way, you know, of saying you were born into a different type of world than we were. And, you know, stories about how they all had to leave school in their teens, by which I mean sort of 13, 14 years old, to work on the farm, to justify the fact that the family occupies a house. They have to contribute to the economy of the farm. They don't need education. They're going to be farm workers, and so on. And comparing the stories that I heard with my own trivial, the things that went wrong for me as a child, you know, I felt frankly ashamed of myself. So that was an enormous, but alongside that historical, both archival and social history taking, oral history taking, the archaeologists literally dug this place up, and we assisted them. So rather than working in the vineyards, the farm workers were assisting the archaeologists in digging up our farm. And there we found the physical evidence. Again, we know these things in the abstract, but to actually find on, like, for example, 50 meters from my front door, we found a Bushman settlement site. I mean, obviously, we excavated it. It wasn't on the surface. Now, the people who live here are descended from Bushmen, from the indigenous, the first people of South Africa. And we found the physical When I say evidence, I mean not just like faint traces. We found thousands of these beautiful microlithic stone tools in the soil. There you have direct proof, if you ever needed it, of the fact that, you know, this place was occupied for thousands of years before my lot came here.
You make the point that discovering these indigenous origins were not considered by the farm workers to be something to be proud of.
Well, that's another story, and it's a very tragic story that, you know, in South Africa, which is an extremely hierarchical society, and the hierarchy is organized racially, the top of that hierarchy is white people. And then there are various shades of, you know, Asian descent and mixed racial descent and African descent. And then at the very bottom of the pile is of Bushman descent. It's they're sort of like marginally qualified as human. You know, so to be a Bushman was an insult. Under apartheid, a term of abuse was to say, for one black person to say to another black person, "Yes, a Bushman, you're a Bushman," is like saying you're barely human. So for us to find all of these beautiful tools, one guy who I remember the incident vividly, and it can illustrate the sort of thing I'm talking about. I think I mentioned him in the article you wrote.
Yes, you did. Yeah,
Benny Daniels. He was part of the excavating of this, the discovering and excavating of this archaeological site, and he brought this little blade, holding it in his hands, and he looked me in the eye in a way that he'd never, and he's of Bushman descent, and he looked me in the eye in a way that he'd never done before, and he said, "You see, Professor," pointing to the stone tool, "my people were here before yours." You know, it was like a personal discovery of something that we all knew, but it was a discovery of, there were layers and layers of meaning in just that one little moment. You know, it was a moment in which he acquired pride in the fact that he was a Bushman, that his people were here before my people. And that observation carries with it implicit questions like, "So just explain to me again why the farm belongs to you, and right. You know, and why is it that I work for you?" You know, these were the kinds of things that, and it wasn't just, you know, you mentioned earlier the slave history of the farm. So the first bit of it was the taking of the farm from the indigenous inhabitants. It was a catastrophe for them. They were hunter-gatherers, the Bushmen. The Khoikhoi were nomadic pastoralists. Neither of these nations had any concept of private land ownership. And so one day they came around in their normal nomadic or hunter-gathering way through this valley over my farm, and they were told, "Get off my land." You know, like they would have, for them it would have been, "What do you mean your land? How can you own land? The land belongs to everyone." You know, and but that's what happened. And so it was the end of their economy. It was the end of their way of life. And it was followed by a genocide. So that was even before slavery. Then they brought slaves, mainly from the East. So my farm was built by slaves. It was quite a, you know, and the historian was finding the archival records of the actual names of the slaves who built my farm, who built my house. You know, it's a beautiful house, I have to tell you, but you start feeling rather differently about it when you realize that the walls were built by slaves, that your children's bedrooms were built by slaves, you know. And the people on the farm, I said Benny Daniels was descended from Bushmen, but those who were not descended, who are not descended from Bushmen, are descended from the slaves, and they are still here. You know, so the people who come with the land, the reason that, and sorry, so after slavery, then there's apartheid, another crime against humanity.
Just to touch base about the slavery, you mentioned how you feel in discovering your land and home were built by the slaves. You write, "The psychological process by which the trauma and abuse of the slaves was twisted back again upon its victims rather than its perpetrators, to produce such deep self-hatred was almost too painful to contemplate. But as the historians explain these things to us, so our attitudes changed until at last it was only me, the landowner, who was left feeling ashamed.
And that's correct.
Yeah. As you're digging up the past was in the literal form, you also established a literal museum to represent it. Can you tell us something about that museum?
Yes. But before I tell you about the museum, I want to say, remember, I began with this kind of benevolent, noblesse oblige kind of attitude. You know, I'm going to do good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It felt like an act of generosity on my part, if you understand what I mean. By the time we'd been through this process, it no longer felt like that. It felt like I absolutely owe, you know, I have a debt that I have to pay, that this is stolen goods, you know, that I'm the beneficiary of all of these horrors, that the way we're living on this farm today is a product of that history directly. You know, it's the reason that I'm relatively wealthy and that they are dirt poor is because of that history. God didn't make us like that. It's because of that history. And that's why, you know, the situation on the farm is as it is. So when you say, quoting me there, that I was the only one who ended up feeling ashamed or something in the direction of self-hatred, you know, it was a changing from thinking I'm going to give something to feeling I am obliged, I am required. This, you can't get away with this. It was that sort of feeling. But yes, so one of the very first things we did was to build a museum. To take one of the old buildings and convert it into a museum, which tells the story, warts and all, of what happened on this farm. The centerpiece of that museum is a wall which is covered in granite, small granite plaques, one of which remembers each of the 200 odd slaves who built this farm against their will, who gave their lives to the development of this farm, to remember them. So that's what the museum was about. And it was a source of great pride to the farm workers. It remains a source of great pride to them. And of course, it's not only of pride to us on the farm. It also became a draw card for people living in similar circumstances on surrounding farms and in surrounding hamlets and villages to come here and to see the physical evidence of the history of how these farms came to be established and came to be the beautiful chocolate box covers that they are today.
You mentioned feeling ashamed, and then you unabashedly engage the reader of the paper, and now in real time, the question, must I give the farm back?
Well, remember that the whole rationale of the history taking was we need to come to a diagnosis. Once you've got a diagnosis, then what treatment is appropriate, because you know this is the illness we're dealing with, and therefore the remedy is you know, whatever it is, depending on what the disease is. So what was absolutely apparent to me was that our diagnosis was it's all about who owns the land. You know, the taking of the land, everything else flowed from that. And the fact that we are in the situation that we're in now, the clinical, the pathological relationship that I spoke of at the outset that needs treating, it's because nothing's changed, you know, that my lot got away with it. They're suffering the consequences still today. And we carry on living a life of, you know, of luxury. And that's what needs to be put right. And it all comes down to the fact that this land, which was theirs, was taken and now it's mine. So yes, the obvious answer to the diagnostic question and to the treatment that flows from it is you've got to give the land back. And so here psychoanalysis comes in again, because what I found happening was, you know, I would lie awake at night in bed thinking, geez, but it happened hundreds of years ago. I didn't take the land, you know, and the people it was taken from, you know, that these are generations later, you know. So why should I give my land to these people? You know, maybe I can divide it up into little pieces and they can each get a piece. But you're not allowed to do that, by the way, with agricultural land in South Africa. It's not permitted to divide it up, because then it's no longer agricultural land. So I thought, well, you see, I would have done that, but I can't. It's illegal. And it's good that it's illegal, because what about food security? You know, if all the farms become residential property, then there's no agriculture left. And please note, when I speak of food security, this is a wine farm. You know, it's not exactly a great contributor to the nutritional needs of the nation. So these were basically rationalizations and defenses. That's what I then had to recognize, that actually what I'm doing is making excuses for why I don't have to do what obviously needs to be done. So I then had to, recognizing that fact, I need to emphasize the word fact, you know, because it's not, it, in other words, it was a clear and existing ongoing, not I didn't want to give the land back. Mm-hmm. That was the fact. So despite all of my professed noble intentions, the fact is that I don't really want to give it back. And now what are we going to do about that?
Whether intentionally or otherwise, the way you word it is you first entertain the question by writing, must I give the farm back? And then as you're struggling with it, you say, I don't want to give my farm back. And it was in that act of ownership where you said, I just don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You said, I just didn't want to and I wouldn't. And then you describe what happened when you shared that interest of yours with the farm workers. You were, I guess, surprised by their reaction.
Well, first of all, that's what you have to do. We had established a process. It was very clear what we were intending to do. We were digging up this place so that we could find out what needed to be put right. And now we had found what needed to be put right. It wasn't only me who realized it's about the land, you know.
Right.
So now how do you face the people that you've been going through this process with and tell them, you know, I'm sorry, actually, truth is, I don't want to give the land back. I know that's what needs to be done. I know that's the right thing to do. If it were only a matter of what is moral and what is ethical, that is what should be done. But the problem is I don't want to. I want to leave this farm to my children. And now what are we going to do? You know, so it's the psychoanalysis, of course, it involves facing facts, facing heartfelt facts, and unwelcome heartfelt facts. Unless you face these facts, there's no way you can deal with them. If you pretend they're not there, they still are there, having their effects. If you face them, then at least there's a possibility you can do something about it.
Let me read how you wrote that, because it was very clear. You write, the fundamental ethic of psychoanalysis is, as you say, to face the facts of what has really happened. We have to face up to what was done in our names and what is still being done, and then we have to deal with those facts. That is what we did at Solms Delta. The outcome was not to blame anybody. The outcome was to get our minds back so that we could think properly again. That's beautifully put. And you were both individually and as a group getting your minds back. And you say that when you presented it to the workers, you write, everybody understands self-interest. as long as you are honest about it, and especially so long as you recognize that others have self-interest too. Problems with self-interest arise only when it is selfish interest, which I thought is nicely put, though it reads more definitive on the page than in real life, of course. What is self-interest and selfish interest?
I think the difference is when you recognize that everybody else has self-interest too. And so you have to take account of your own self-interest, but so do you have to take account of everybody else's self-interest. And that's how you can come up with fair solutions.
And this began a really remarkable, I don't know if rehabilitation is the word, but a new energy that you brought when facing your self-interest that you wanted to keep the farm. That was hardly the end of the story. You devoted yourself over many, many, many years, and the impression I have with a great deal of financial investment, to create something that works for everybody in ways that were quite unique in your area, if not the country. So share that with us, if you would.
Well, so the most important part of what of the solution we came up with, because if you try to find a solution together, you can. If you really are taking account of each other's interest, and that includes your own, you can find a solution. It's only if you don't face the problems that you can't find a solution, or if you don't want to find a solution. So it didn't require rocket science. The idea was that since I want to keep my farm, I have this debt, moral debt, and it's all about land ownership, the obvious thing to do is to acquire the land, to acquire land, but preferably land next door, because everyone lives here, to buy the adjoining farm, for the farm workers, and so then we can form a partnership. So they own the farm next to me, I keep my farm, and we form a partnership and work together. Now, I'm not a billionaire, so land in this valley in the Winelands outside Cape Town is extremely expensive. So the farm that we bought next to mine is every bit as beautiful and historically significant and therefore every bit as expensive as my own farm. So the only way I could do that was to take a mortgage, to take a loan against my farm. And I had an English, a British friend who owns the farm next to mine, and he joined me in this. He was of a like mind to me. And so the two of us, his name was Richard Astor, and we mortgaged our farms, the bank loan that we obtained enabled us to buy the farm next door to both of our farms for the farm workers. And we then formed a trust, the beneficiaries of which were the farm workers, and that's how we enabled the farm workers to own land. Without giving up my own. But the other things we did, which I'll just rattle through quickly, were the obvious things like, we formed a partnership in the business. So we were equal shareholders in the business. We're pulling in the same direction. We're
with the farm workers. Your partners with the farm workers, is that it?
Yes, that's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so, as I say, we were equal shareholders in the business that farmed their farm and my own and my friend Richard's. And they were now not only landowners, but also equity partners, equal partners in the business. And so that was an important thing. From that flowed, how are we going to use our resources? It's terribly, the wine industry is slow. Everything about wine is slow. You don't make quick profits in the wine industry. You invest now for something that will deliver returns in the long run. So it was important that we couldn't wait for this long run because that's also what the farm workers or black South Africans generally have experienced all too often, promises that, you know, in the future, things will be better. It was necessary to deliver some benefits immediately. So we started using income from our wine sales to fund things like better housing for the workers, access to satellite television, which any middle-class person takes for granted. And it's important for the kids to become part of the world and to pay for proper education for the children, because the education that's normally provided for farm kids is abysmal. And that sort of thing, you know, proper salaries and so on, proper healthcare. But alongside that, we also started cultural projects. It began with the museum, but there were things that flowed from that. The two most interesting of which were, firstly, Bushmen have a deep knowledge of what can be eaten in terms of the indigenous flora. So we planted a large part of the farm to this, it's called fynbos, edible fynbos. And we established a restaurant in the farm which served cuisine from the land using ingredients that were used hundreds of, well, in fact, thousands of years ago. And there's a pride in that. And so the people on the farm became waiters and chefs and so on, and told the stories to visitors, you know, about, you know, the, all of these incredible roots and fruits and leaves and whatnot, you know, that we eat. And so we made a very interesting sort of culinary thing, going all the way back, you know, to the deepest historical origins of the people who live here, and slave cuisine too. That was also, you know, there's a fantastic rich history of the cuisine brought from the East by the slaves, because South African slaves all came from the East.
Help us out. When you say the East, you mean where exactly?
I mean mainly the Indonesian archipelago, but also Southeast Asia, the subcontinent of Asia, India, and some from the east coast of Africa, especially Mozambique and Madagascar.
Okay.
So anything east of Cape Town was the East, but it was mostly fairly far east. And so that was one thing. The other thing was music. They're incredible, just as they are in America, you know, from the, your slave heritage. They're incredible musical traditions that arise. So here we have the pre-colonial musical traditions and the slave early colonial musical traditions. And the people on, especially the old people on the farms, we wanted to record those who still knew the old songs and so on, and the old tunes and the old instruments. So we filmed them for archival purposes, but that sparked such a flame of interest amongst the youngsters that they said, can we make a band? You know, and so then we had a band, and then we had another band, and we eventually had a choir and a marching band and a folk stage band, and they started making, you know, recording music and so on. So and we had a huge party at the end of the harvest every year called an Usfias, which means a harvest festival, where they would perform for thousands of people. You know, it was amazing. So those are all the things that went right as a result.
Right. We're going to get to what didn't go right, but let me just read what you wrote specifically about music. You say, today the trust provides lessons in strings, brass, percussion, voice, and songwriting to over 200 people, drawn not only from our own farm, but from those of our neighbors and even from the townships beyond. We have four musical ensembles who have released successful CDs and are in heavy demand at local events. And that's towards the end of the paper. And to return to the beginning, when you wrote that psychoanalysis played an important, if unexpected, role in this success, the paper and the events you described so far make a remarkable picture. It's very moving, both about you, your family, your mindset, the workers who participated with you, and it's just a beautiful thing. But there's a but to it.
Yes.
And let me just ask you to flesh out the but.
Before I flesh out the but, I want to just say that many journalists came to this farm during that period and interviewed the farm workers and asked them about, you know, what was important about what had changed in their lives. And the things that they spoke of weren't material things so much, things like land ownership and, you know, and health insurance and proper education for their kids and so on. The things that they foregrounded were psychological things like pride and self-esteem, you know, a sense of ownership, a sense of belonging, a sense of recognition. So I just wanted to say that. And that includes a reclaiming of the cultural, you know, these cultural traditions. Now, the but is the following. I've already mentioned that in the wine industry, you've got to play a long game. More than that, though, it's a very competitive industry where there are very small margins. I don't know if this applies all over the world, but in South Africa, it's a very it's a crowded market, and everybody who makes a billion, you know, at the end of their successful career in finance or in tech or whatever, mining, their reward at the end is they get a trophy called a wine farm, you know, and they've all got more money than sense. And so they're pouring money into these narcissistic projects where there's a return on ego rather than a return on investment, you know. And so it's a crowded market, and you're competing against people who have, you know, endless resources. Now, in that situation, bear in mind that we had expenses that nobody else had. In this very competitive industry, we were paying off a loan, 46 million rand loan for the farm next door. That was the interest rates in South Africa are above 10%. So, you know, you're paying just on the interest alone, let alone the capital repayment, an enormous debt, a burden of debt. Plus, we built all these houses. Plus, we were paying all these school fees. Plus, we were paying all these medical fees. You know, plus, we were running all of these projects. And so we had expenses that nobody else had. And, you know, I don't mean that we were foolhardy. I think we had to do the things that we did. They're basic things like, you know, if investment in the future, you've got to properly educate the kids. You know, you've got to live in a decent house. I don't mean a mansion, but, you know, you have to have the basics. You can't defer those sorts of things. But what we got wrong was we kept thinking that we would, that our wine sales would cover all of this, you know, and they didn't. So we ran at a loss year after year, kept on thinking, well, next year we're gonna break even, next year, you know, and I'm not a business person, you know, so you must also remember, as much as my psychoanalytic skills came in handy, what I lacked was any business experience. And this place wasn't being run as a business. And in fact, let me also add, I never had the intention of making money, but I wanted the place to be self-sustaining, self-supporting. I certainly never intended to lose money, you know, in the long run. So we were, the main problem, the main thing that went wrong initially was we ran out of runway in terms of, so our sales kept going up and up and up, but they never quite reached the level of what was going out in terms of expenses. So we needed an investor. We needed somebody. Now, you don't get an investor. In fact, I have many wealthy friends who could easily have afforded to invest in what we were doing. But I mean, they had the money. But as soon as they came and discovered the structure of our business. They realize this is not a business. You know, you can't make money here. This is a social enterprise. Why would I want to invest in this? And so, it was an absolute miracle that the government got to hear about our plight. Well, how it worked was that the South African government, which is a socialist government, which was elected, you know, by the majority of our population, which is mostly pretty, you know, it's the most unequal society in the world, and so working class and unemployed people make up a very large majority. So the government represents the interests of the underclass, represents the interests of the very people, you know, that we were focusing, whose interests we were focusing on in this farm. So the government has been trying to do this sort of thing, reform land ownership in South Africa, and they came up with a plan, which they announced in the media, which is that they will, if landowners, which means white people, if landowners will share their farm with their farm workers, then the government will pay for the 50% share of the farm workers. So the farmer gets rewarded for doing exactly the same thing that we were doing anyway, with a capital injection from government. So I was invited. It was very controversial, this legislation that was going through Parliament, and I was invited to speak on a radio program to give my opinion about this proposed legislation, and I gave my opinion, which was I thought it was fantastic. And if only this legislation had applied when we did what we did, because we did it anyway without any support from government. That led the government to contact me, and they said, do you want to be the flagship for this new program to show, because you're already a success, you know, all you need is capital. So you'll be the first project that we'll support. And so I thought, as I said, that it's a miracle, you know, God is good. We're being rewarded for, we're being saved by our government, who's not trying to make money. They're trying to do what we're trying to do, which is to do the right thing and to put this, you know, to tackle the terrible inequalities and that have arisen from our history of colonialism and slavery and apartheid. And so I welcome them investing in our business with open arms. What they did was meant to happen over two stages. The first was they would relieve us of the debt in terms of the ownership of the farm, so of the workers' farm. So they paid off the bank loan, and now the farm was owned outright. But here was the first mistake. They took over ownership of the workers' farm, not the workers. So they bought from the bank the loan, they paid off the loan, and now government was the owner of the land next door. And I said, but hang on, isn't the whole idea that this is going to, this is for the workers to receive, to become landowners? And now you're taking away their land rather than, they said, no, it's just in our procedures, you've got to do it this way. You have to show that it's viable for 5 years. Then we transfer the land to the beneficiaries. So I said, but it's already viable. They said, no, you're not making a profit yet. So, you know, we'll hold it in custody. We'll become custodians of the land for the farm workers. But after 5 years, we'll give it to them. That was the first thing. The second part of the plan was that they were going to recapitalize the business. You know, that now that we had this proper partner with money, because, you know, our partner, the farm workers, they had nothing. So now we have a partner in government who's got endless resources. So we're going to draw up a plan, a turnaround strategy, as they called it, whereby we will now properly capitalize this farm on a 50-50 basis. They will pay 50% and we will pay 50%. So I said, great. I said, but you've got to pay your 50% first, because, you know, I've run out of money, basically. So once with your 50% recapitalization, we start showing profits, then I can take out loans again, you know, and pay my 50%. But at the moment, nobody's going to lend us money because we're not profitable. So they said, fine, we'll do it that way. So the land, remember, the ownership of the land didn't go to the workers, it went to government. And secondly, the recapitalization of the farm never came. And so I literally had run out of money, but I was just like scraping the barrel to keep. We did this turnaround strategy. It was a great strategy, but it needed funding. And the funding was coming from me, the guy who was running out of money. And they gave all sorts of excuses about why the money wasn't coming. And in the end, it just never came. Hmm. And to cut a very long story short, eventually we ran out of money, literally ran out of money. And I don't know what the equivalent is in America, but here you can file for a thing called a business rescue. If the business is viable, you can be protected from creditors by appointing a business rescue practitioner who draws up a plan for how to get the farm out of the hole that it's in.
It sounds like what we call bankruptcy.
No, it's not bankrupt. Well, it's probably very similar. And so we had to do that, which was a terrible embarrassment, you know, and because still the government hadn't paid their money. The minute that we did that, they said, oh my God, no, you got to reverse this process. We've got the money. So we said, we can't reverse the process. It's a legal process now that you got to go through. And to cut a long story short, it turned out, so our business rescue practitioner, they wanted to replace the person who we had appointed, a proper person, you know, with an accountant from a reputable PricewaterhouseCoopers or something like that. They wanted to replace that practitioner. So we said, fine, if that's what it takes, you know, replace it with your person. The person they replaced them with was a gangster. I mean, I can say that without fear of being sued, because you know this is like it's all over. This there's the capture of our state by gangsters, you know, by criminals, is well documented, and so we became part of that. The money that was meant to come to us, God knows who ended up actually getting it. So we suddenly found ourselves in, you know, what I thought had been the most fabulous miracle of saving by the government, it ended up being that we were in partnership with, we might as well been in partnership with the mafia, you know, and we were, this was Jacob Zuma's government, which then famously was exposed for being, you know, like terribly, terribly corrupt, and that they were basically pillaging from the state on a grand scale. We eventually had a whole commission of inquiry appointed by his successor with the deputy chief justice of our country did this commission of inquiry exposing all of this, you know, and now prosecutions have followed and are following, and you know there's a real cleaning up of it all. But basically I went into partnership with an extremely corrupt government and they just destroyed us.
There is, dare say, a happy or happier ending or yes. Middle phase. Do let us know the recent turn of events that gives you hope.
I don't want to underestimate what a dark period we went through, because it was a real shock to us all, and it was terrible. But what we needed was to replace the government with a proper investor, so that's what we now finally have done. Not due to any special skill on my part. An American, in fact, an African-American named Tommy Hall, saw a documentary about our farm, which was taken just before things went so badly wrong. It was a documentary on one of the British television channels. And and many people contacted me during that dark period and said, I've seen this wonderful documentary about you or read about you and so on. You know, I'd like to come and visit. I'd like to be part. And I have to tell all of them, sorry, it's not going so wonderfully anymore. So I told the same thing to this chap, Tommy Hall. And he said, no, but this is too important to be allowed to fail. And so he has now has invested and is continuing to invest in a very helpful way. So everything's come back on track or coming back on track. We didn't make wine for 6 years. We made our first vintage last year, 2023, again. We had our first harvest festival, that party with the musicians and all of that this year. And everything slowly returning back. Thanks to an American. Thank God for America, or at least for part of it.
You know, when I had asked you about it, because I had done some reading and had a sense of the dark period, and I asked you about what reflections you had on whether you're taking care of the workers in such a decent way was viable under the circumstances that turned out to be. And your answer, I think, is one that applies to your business and to our field of psychoanalysis. You say it's a long game. Wine is a long game. You can't just help people by fixing their homes and bringing in teachers, as essential as that is. As you also pointed out in your paper, Nelson Mandela, for all his genius and courage, can't automatically turn a country around. It's a long game. And psychoanalysis obviously is a long game with very difficult, challenging periods that are filled with uncertainty. With many patients is, how are we going to emerge from this? And all I can say is I think your paper stands. It stands as part one of your effort. There is another part that I look forward to, part two, which includes some reference to the business challenges and the psychoanalytic steadiness that you bring to those challenges. And I look forward to being able to do what I can't do now, which is to find a bottle of your wine here in the States, because I thought, how else could we have this conversation if I haven't tasted your wine? But not yet. So I look forward to that day.
Thank you very much, Avi. Thank you.
Thank you for your courage. I'll say courage. You're very transparent in this whole process, both the good and the troubling. And you've really contributed something for us all to think about how we bring an analytic sensibility to work in our lives and in our community. So I'm grateful. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.